be honest, earlier in the week I was going to preach on something else tonight until a few of us met on Friday morning and Brother Alan English talked to us a little bit about patience and perseverance around an IHOP table. And I warned the guys at that point there might be a lesson coming out of this. And I told Brother Ken about that, and he said, "Well, we were there for an hour. You're allowed to shorten it." I said, "I was planning to preach till midnight, the authorized hour." And he gave me a thumbs down, so I don't know what that means. But really, this is just, in my mind, an overflow of some of these thoughts. And I want to begin with Proverbs 9 and verse 10, which simply says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. And one of the common objections that people have to God is that He does not explain Himself adequately. For example, if love is compatible with suffering, then why doesn't He explain it better, they would ask. If He really does exist, why doesn't He make Himself more demonstrable, a more demonstrable show of Himself? Why doesn't He do that? And of course, believers see by faith how God has done just that. But to the unbeliever, faith cannot have such a role. And so we have to see to believe, and since God isn't obvious, then they say faith is unreasonable. So how then does faith reconcile what appears to be difficulties? And really, it's a way of thinking about the idea that what is it that gives us that indication that we need to be patient, that we need to persevere, that we need to continue in our faith instead of simply throwing up our hands and quitting because things get difficult. But it's not just personal difficulties I'm talking about here. It's looking in the Bible and seeing what we may think are contradictory ideas, or at least difficult ideas. And I'll give you some examples of that here in a moment, because I want to look specifically at Abraham in just a few moments. But I want to begin really by thinking about the fact that, you know, these ideas that are in the Bible that appear to be difficult and sometimes contradictory to some people, how do we think about it? How do we go about understanding these things? I want to start with the basic idea that by faith we understand there is more to reality than materialism. One of the reasons that people see contradictory ideas in Scripture is that they cannot see the spiritual explanations that are needed to grasp the material reality. And we're looking for material explanations of material problems, and so we cannot make sense of where the real answers are found in the Bible. But if we close off spiritual reality, then what we're essentially doing is saying there can be no reasonable explanation for some of the conundrums that appear in our minds in Scripture. And so they see the problem, and their worldview won't permit the spiritual answer. And so they say there's contradiction. And there's no reason to follow God at that point. And if they're going to judge the alleged problems of the Bible that the Bible itself initiates, that the Bible itself talks about, then they also ought to let the Bible provide the explanations that make sense of the very problems they're dealing with. And so this may be, and I'm thinking here in 1 Corinthians 2, the statement is made in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 14 that the natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised. And so this may be one of the reasons for that. If you've blocked off spiritual reality, then you won't make sense of the spiritual answers that are given. And all you can see would be contradiction and problems. Now, in this context, Paul had been pointing out that the cross is foolishness. That this is one of the difficulties that people have. How can you believe that a crucified person 2,000 years ago can be the Savior of the world. Well, they had the same problem back then. How can you believe that this Jewish peasant from Nazareth could possibly die on a cross and thereby save people from their sins? It's just absolute folly. They saw no reason in that. It was folly to them. To the Jews, it was a stumbling block, Paul says. And so the Jews couldn't make any sense out of that. Person who hangs on the cross, he's hanging on a tree. He is cursed. That can't possibly be the Messiah who's going to establish his kingdom. Cannot be. So they see these irreconcilable differences here in these problems in the Bible, and they don't see the spiritual explanations that are given. To understand the cross, you have to look beyond the material explanation that a man died on a cross. To understand what God did in his plans, we have to see the spiritual undergirding of what that plan represents. And so if we're stuck on a material explanation, we'll never get it. And I think that's one of the problems we have. So Paul makes the point also that his preaching and his message, and this is earlier in 1 Corinthians 2, verses 4 and 5, that his preaching and his message were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. Now, if all we're doing is looking for material explanations for these things, that's going to be a reliance upon the wisdom of men. We'll never get it. We'll never understand it. So by faith, we see that there's a greater reality here. And so when people trust the wisdom of men, they inevitably are going to think that there are contradictions in the message and that that message is just plain ridiculous. When looked at from a purely human perspective, from a purely materialistic perspective, what other conclusion can you draw? But when, by faith, we begin to see the spiritual reality, the door is wide open for a greater understanding. And if we try to understand everything from within a closed box of materialism, we will be unable to understand spiritual truth. And even Paul understood his own suffering was based upon the greater spiritual reality. From a material perspective, it would not have made much sense for Paul to suffer the way that he did, because his suffering was voluntary. I mean, he could have walked away from that, just like he says about Demas. Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world. I take that basically to mean that Demas understood that as long as he's traveling with Paul, he is in harm's way, and I don't want to be there anymore. Paul could have walked away. It was his choice. And it wouldn't make much sense just from that perspective, but from the greater reality, here's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart. But though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For a momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal. Things which are not seen are eternal. And I often marvel at what Paul says here about that, because he says our light affliction, and you think about all the things Paul went through, read 2 Corinthians 11 sometime, and you see the point. Paul suffered a great deal, and yet he says it's a light affliction. How could he say that? Because he could see a greater eternal reality. If it's just the raw material we're talking about, going through this kind of suffering would not have made any sense. The reality of Paul's physical suffering was mitigated by the fact that there is a greater spiritual reality that is eternal. And since there is that eternal reality, then any suffering we go through for the cause of Christ is reasonable, if not necessary. So by faith we understand there's more to reality than materialism. Secondly, By faith, we understand and realize that God is greater than we are and doesn't have to explain himself to us. And this point we've made many times. But you know, it's difficult not to know why things happen the way that they do. We are people who want to know, why is this happening? And we yearn to understand why God allows certain things to happen in certain ways, or why God prohibits things from happening as he sometimes does. And while wanting to understand like that is a natural thing, faith recognizes, as Ephesians 3:20 says, that God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything that we ask or think. God is greater. And that should be expected because God, being who he is not limited by finite abilities the way that we are. Faith is able then to look beyond and look at God for who he is. Look at him as he is for who he is and be content that God has answers even when we don't fully understand. And of course, Job is a perfect example of this dilemma. We see what Job didn't see. We get to kind of peek behind the curtain, as it were, in the first two chapters and see what's going on behind the scenes there when Satan challenges and God allows Job then to suffer. But Job felt wronged. We have to understand that. Job felt wronged. And he didn't know why God allowed him to suffer as he did. We hear the agony in Job's words in Job 19:21 when he says, pity me, O my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. And even so, Job wouldn't give up his faith. Listen to what he says in Job 19 and verse 23. Job 19 and verse 23. He says, oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. That with an iron stylus and lead, they were engraved in the rock forever. As for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see, and not another. My heart faints within me. That ultimately Job was, even though he didn't understand, he wanted to understand, he thought he was wrong, he was still going back to God and saying, I don't get it. In the end, he had to be content with that. Learning to be content with unanswered questions, that's a difficult thing. But again, that's mitigated by the fact that God is greater and God doesn't have to explain himself to us. I can't demand that of God. He doesn't need to be explained in order to be trusted this way. And I think we get ourselves into trouble when we try to explain things away based on our own ignorance. I don't understand, therefore, God must not know what he's doing. That's one reason why faith and patience, why faith and perseverance go hand in hand. When we trust, we can persevere. When we trust, we can be patient. We may not understand why, but we can trust the one who does understand why. And this also goes to the fact that God doesn't always do things the way we expect or think. I mean, if God were again confined to our finite perspective, he would lack the ability and the wisdom that he has. Because I don't have that wisdom and ability, do you? But to box God in, and I want to tie this to what Zach was talking about this morning, to box God in really is a form of idolatry. Because what we're doing is we're taking God and turning him into a creature after our own likeness, because we're boxed in finiteness. We don't have the knowledge and the understanding and that wisdom. And essentially what we're doing is taking God and saying, well, he can't have that kind of knowledge and wisdom and understanding. And that's idolatrous because we're forming God after our image at that point. We are not his Lord. He is ours. And keeping that perspective, I believe, is vital. Now, thirdly, I want to go back to Abraham as a test case in Genesis 22 to see how all this kind of works and is put together. We'll consider Abraham's faith because it demonstrates what happens, you know, when he's told to do something very difficult, and that's an understatement. Think about the problem presented in Genesis 22. Abraham was told that Isaac was the child of promise. God told him this. He was the one that Abraham and Sarah had waited for. They were generally patient, occasionally impatient, but overall they were generally patient. They persevered. They struggled. Isaac was finally born, and the seed promise was being fulfilled. God told Abraham at this point to take Isaac, your only son, that is the son of promise, and offer him as a sacrifice. How can that be? Isn't that contradictory to the promises? To take the son of promise and kill him, wouldn't that be? And isn't that a little bit contradictory to the nature of God? Why would God doesn't want human sacrifice. Can you imagine all the things that might have gone through Abraham's mind? What in the world would you do with something like that? God made a promise on the one hand, and then tells him to kill the child of that promise on the other. I mean, how do you make sense of that? From a purely human perspective, from a purely materialistic perspective, there is really no way out of this problem. And this is why, you know, why do unbelievers often point to this very thing when they want to show problems in the Bible? Because they're looking at it from a purely materialistic perspective. And when you do that, there is no way out of this problem. God is asking Abraham to kill the son of promise. And that alone is repugnant, we think. Is this not proof, the unbeliever says, that the Bible is erroneous, brutish, contradictory? And if we approach this issue again from that perspective, it's understandable that one would be so confused by this. But there's another path to this answer. So my real question here is, how does Abraham reconcile this in his thinking? And I'm asking it this way, what did Abraham bring to the table as he approached this particular conundrum? What did he bring to the table? Because again, we understand that really his answer was it was by faith. But what does that entail here? First, he already had good reason to trust God. This is what he's bringing to the table. He already had good reason to trust God. This is the first peg in this puzzle here. He'd already followed God's instructions to move away from the land of his birth to go to this new promised land. Hebrews 11 and verse 8 explains, by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive as inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Now I want you to notice in that last statement there, what was Abraham's perspective? His perspective was not just some kind of materialistic thing. Oh, I get to go to a land and I get to get a bunch of riches. That's not what he was looking at. He was looking for the city whose architect and builder is God. He had an eternal perspective. He understood what we said at the beginning, that there's a greater reality here than just the material stuff. And he understood that God is greater and didn't need to explain himself to him. So he went out even when he didn't know exactly where he was going to end up. He was following God's instructions. He already had good reason to trust God. And secondly, in line with that, we think about God's covenant oath to him. God made a promise and swore an oath to Abraham by himself. And it's impossible that God would lie. God is faithful. Abraham knew this. And I believe this is the second of the pegs of the puzzle that Abraham was working with. He could bring this to the table of this conundrum in Genesis 22. He knew he could trust what God had promised, and he knew that no matter what was going to happen, Isaac was that child of promise, and that wasn't going to change. Why? Well, God's promise was given as a covenant. And God gave Abraham the assurance of that covenant. Genesis 15 describes the extent to which God went in order to enter into this covenant with Abraham to show how serious he was about this. And you recall, he had Abraham get these animals and cut the animals in half, and God is the one who passed between the pieces of the animal. That was a customary thing in the ancient world in establishing a covenant. By passing between the pieces of the animal, God was giving his word in such a way that would bring a curse upon himself if he should fail to do so. And so Hebrews 6 and verse 13 tells us, when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you. And so, having patiently waited, he obtained the promise. For men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute. I mean, think about that. We sometimes will say, my word is my bond, you know. I've given my yes, and that ought to be good enough, and it's the end of dispute as far as I'm concerned, because I've given my word, that's the end of it. God gave his word, and that's the end of it right there for Abraham. There was no dispute in Abraham's mind about this. In the same way, God, desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us. This hope we have is an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil. Not long ago, we talked about this living hope and looked at this passage a little bit, but that idea of recognizing that because God made an oath, God made a covenant vow, we can believe what he said. The Hebrews writer also says in Hebrews 11 and verse 11, that by faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. One of the things that Abraham had learned over those years, and again, though ultimately he was patient, there were times when they, jumped ahead. But the point is that what Abraham learned by the end of that time is that God doesn't do things the way you expect him to do things. God doesn't conform himself to finite rules. And so here you have this idea that Abraham had already learned over this time. He and Sarah both, now they have a child well past the age of childbearing. And that was proof enough that God meant what he said. This is what Abraham is working with, I believe, in his own mind. For him, the promise was beyond dispute, and no wonder he could be called the friend of God. While Abraham didn't always understand, he did continue to persevere because he knew he could trust God This is what he's bringing to the table of the sacrifice of Isaac from Genesis 22. Third, Abraham knew God would always do what's right. This is the third peg of the puzzle that Abraham has that he can work with. And you recall what Abraham said to when God told him that it was necessary to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah back in Genesis 18 and 19. He talked with God about this. He pleaded with God about this. What if we could just find so many righteous people? And of course, he worked his way down 50, 40, 30, you know. What about 10? Now, God knew how many righteous people there were. The fact is, they couldn't even put together 10 of them. But you remember that question Abraham asked? Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? Now, the problem, of course, is that there weren't enough righteous people to spare those cities, but Abraham believed that God would do justice, that God would do what is right no matter what. In Genesis 22, as Abraham and Isaac approached the place for sacrifice, Isaac asked in verse 7, "Where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Can you imagine? And Isaac is a young boy, and he doesn't know what's about to happen. They've got the wood, and they're going up here, and they're going to do this, and he's going to be a part of it, but where's the lamb for the sacrifice? And I want you to notice the faith that's represented by Abraham's answer in 22 and verse 8. God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. Abraham didn't say to Isaac, "Isaac, I'm sorry, you're the sacrifice. Where's the lamb?" God's going to provide it. Now you might say, well, how did he know? Of course, as we know, God does provide, but How? Because this is his faith. This is the faith that he's working with. God will provide is a statement that shows Abraham's faith in the Lord to do what's right and to do what's just. Abraham may not have fully understood how this would happen, but he trusted that God would take care of things in his own way. God will do what is right. He'll handle things his way. It may not be how we would handle it. Likely won't even be a way that we would understand it fully. But it's okay if we have faith. We don't have to know it all. We can know that we can trust God. And he'll do what is right. So with all of that in place, he had good reason to trust God. He knew God's covenant oath. God won't lie. And he knew God would always do what's right. The fourth thing here is that he knew God is all powerful. Abraham knew that God would take care of this situation. And he could act with confidence that God would somehow, some way, handle this outcome. And if Abraham were looking at this issue from a purely material perspective, he may well have concluded that there was absolutely no way to reconcile this situation, God's promises with these instructions. How could you possibly reconcile that from a material perspective? Yet in Abraham's mind, how he reconciles this issue is truly magnificent. It's astonishing, especially in these times, as seen in Hebrews 11 and verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It is he of whom it was said, in Isaac your descendants shall be called. He considered that God is able to raise the dead, raise people from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. That's remarkable because the idea of personal resurrection was not a common belief in the ancient world. People thought that when you died, you were dead. You weren't coming back bodily. That's really what resurrection indicates, by the way. It wasn't just a bodiless existence out there, but it indicates the body would be alive. Even if changed, it would be alive. As far as we know from the biblical text, Abraham wasn't told about resurrection. But by faith, by a great inference, he concluded that God must have in mind raising Isaac from the dead if he truly intended for this sacrifice to be made. Why? Because he's the child of promise and God doesn't lie. And God is able. The only way Abraham could have done this was by the consideration of God's power coupled with God's promises. He considered God is able. That is a major statement of faith right there. Again, as Ephesians 3:20 puts it, God is able to do far more abundantly beyond anything we can ask or think. And if we can keep that fresh in our minds, we have the same tools that Abraham had. We have the same tools Abraham was working with to be able to work ourselves through those difficulties and questions that come when we begin to think too materialistically and we wonder how could this possibly be. We need to step back and think of the greater implications. Faith reconciles difficulties by understanding that God is bigger than the physical, that God is greater than we are, that we already have good reason to trust God. God has made promises he will not go back on. He is faithful and he cannot lie. He will always do the right thing and he is able, all powerful. Once we see these points, we have all the pegs in place to see that what we consider to be difficulties may indeed find greater answers than what we might first have imagined. You would be getting ready to sing the song that was chosen this evening. There's no light thing in the New Testament when it talks about us following the faith of Abraham. That we, by faith, really become the children of Abraham. Because when you stop and think about the nature of Abraham's faith, it really was pretty remarkable that he would do what he did. But that's what we're called to be. It's what we're called to do. Life is bigger than what you can see. Let's keep that in mind. If tonight you are not yet a child of God, you need to die with Christ and be buried with him in baptism that you might be raised up to walk a new life. We want to help you do that. If we can help you this evening, let us know. Come as we stand and sing.